commencing countdown.
3, 2, 1.
This is the Contracting Experience. Connecting government contracting professionals to the world around them through conversations with acquisition influencers, insights into evolving hot topics, and sharing lessons learned from the field.
Welcome, podcast listeners. On this episode of The Contracting Experience, we're privileged to have with us Mr. Joe Fountain, a member of the Senior Executive Service and the Director of Contracting for the Air Force Lifecycle Management Center, LCMC, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Mr. Fountain brings a wealth of experience to the podcast. He manages a staggering $40 billion in annual obligations and oversees more than 2,100 contracting professionals across 12 operating locations. What's truly inspiring for our workforce is that he started his government service right here in the Air Force as a Copper Cap trainee in 2004 and has risen to the highest levels of enterprise leadership. Today, we'll be discussing the nuances of managing massive portfolios, the difference between sustainment and lifecycle management, and how our contracting professionals can navigate complex acquisitions while staying connected to the ultimate mission, supporting the warfighter. Welcome, Mr. Fountain. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the podcast today and really looking forward to the discussion. So thank you.
All right. Excellent, sir. Let's dive in. We're thrilled to have you. So I'd like to start right at the beginning of your career. You started off as a government civil servant in 2004 as a Copper Cap trainee at Robins Air Force Base, and you're now an SES Director of Contracting. So looking back, what were the most critical lessons you learned during your years in the Copper Cap program that still influence your leadership decisions today?
Wow, Rob. Well, I'm pretty sure the thought of being an SES was not something really on my mind at the time back when I was a Copper Cap. But one of the things that I'll say I learned and brought with me is that really you just have to be open to new challenges and to not shy away from what I'll say things are that are hard. You know, when you're starting in your government career, everything is foreign. Just learning the language of acquisition and the Air Force contracting is really a daunting task. So, however, you've got to challenge yourself. You got to be open to really being uncomfortable and just willing to jump in and learn your way, because it happens to all of us. So having that really the openness to take on new challenges and really work through those is really something I would say I've learned early on. And, you know, I think today it's pretty clear as we roll into this acquisition transformation. It's a big change, and we're learning to be comfortable being uncomfortable. Many of these changes and challenges, as we're working through them, they're really new to all of us. So it's no different than when you just started out, that you got to be open to that challenge and willing to really just jump in with both feet and take it on and keep moving forward.
All right, sir. Excellent. Yeah, that foundation is just absolutely so important. And then, so building on that, your career chronology is incredibly diverse, right? You've been a PCO for C-5s, helicopters, C-130s, training aircraft, and even Global Hawk. So how important is it for a contracting professional to rotate through different platforms and directorates versus becoming a deep subject matter expert in maybe one specific system?
All right. Thanks, Rob. But overall, I'm a believer in contracting is really contracting. And all of our program offices have a plethora of various opportunities to learn contracting. One thing that diversity of experience provides is really that opportunity to see the various ways of doing things. It provides that broader experience or perspective. You know, frequently in our career field, there's multiple ways to come to a solution or to solve a problem. And a lot of our contracting success is really just based on that ability to do critical thinking. You know, we have our textbook, we have the RFO, but having that broad experience provides us with that really the greater perspective to solve problems and to apply the, you know, the various tools in our toolbox. So I guess what I would say is that I found is that, you know, working at, you know, different locations, different centers, and really AFMC as well, overall very beneficial. And it really just provides that higher level of understanding. So as you're going up into becoming a senior leader or a more senior supervisor, so forth, it just allows you to connect those pieces, and it gives you a greater ability to come to solutions. And at the end of the day, to deliver that holistic readiness, air power to our mission users out there. So I think it's important to first to know your craft. And then once you know all that and the blocking and tackling, which you can learn in any of our contracting offices, getting that breadth just really allows you to put those pieces together, and I think improves that critical thinking aspect and allows us to solve problems.
All right. Excellent. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm sure that breadth of experience is certainly valuable in your current capacity. Because as the previous director of contracting for AFSC, the Sustainment Center, and now director of contracting at Lifecycle Management Center, you oversee contracting operations at multiple locations with billions of dollars in annual obligations. So what's your strategy for maintaining standardization and quality across this vast enterprise?
So really, it's a balance. So, you know, you're trying to balance between regimented standardization, but also without inhibiting innovation. So in my position, you know, I strive for standardization, but also encourage our people to try new things and take some risk. We push for the standardization because, that consistency drives efficiency. And, you know, through those standard procedures, whether that's, you know, policy guidance, training, guides, TTPs, you know, our self-inspection program, all those things drive that standardization. But at the same time, we're also wanting our workforce to have at their disposal all the tools in the toolbox. So then we're also empowering them to think and to solve problems. At the end of the day, that requires a higher level of understanding to be able to do that. But again, I think that's clearly connected in what we're being asked to do in acquisition transformation. So my aspiration is for us to have empowered, mission-focused contract professionals. And we're going to continue to provide that standardization, whether it's training, guides, et cetera. But at the same time, we don't want to handcuff the workforce to really apply, whether it's through OTs or CSOs or just different unique contracting structures. So we want to keep it open, but it's really a balancing act to maintain that efficiency and standardization, but at the same time, not inhibit, thinking and innovation.
All right, sir. Excellent. Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. And I've used this analogy on a previous podcast. It's kind of like ladder climbing versus rock climbing, right? You got the standardization, the ladder climbing, right? You got that next rung. It's exactly where it should be, but sometimes maybe the rungs are out of place. Maybe something isn't quite right. And empowering your people to maybe go rock climbing at that point. Again, huge investment in your people and a lot of trust there as well.
Yeah, exactly, Rob. Because it's in some cases, there's things that you want the ladder for, right? And you want it to be standard and you want it to be repeatable. And you do it because it's just pure efficiency and it doesn't require that, greater level of thinking. But that doesn't apply to everything. And when you try to make it apply, it actually inhibits efficiency. So it's just knowing, we'll say, what, when and where to apply those processes is what we're really seeking and empowering our teams.
All right, sir. Excellent. Again, makes a lot of sense there. And then speaking of your transition recently, right, from the Air Force Sustainment Center to now LCMC, so sustainment contracting, right, dealing with spares and modifications and contractor logistics support often requires kind of maybe a different mindset than buying a brand new weapon system. So what's the biggest hurdle your teams have faced when trying to keep legacy aircraft flying, and how maybe industry can be a better partner with us in that space?
So overall, I think that sustainment contracting is vastly underestimated when it comes to the complexity and the challenges that you face on a day-to-day. Many people just think AFSC does sustainment. In reality, it's LCMC is a core part of LCMC is also sustainment. And then also there's some DLA components to that as well. And overall, the sustainment enterprise is a very complex, significant role that allows our aircraft to maintain readiness. And what you're doing as sustainment is you're not delivering capability. You're actually allowing the aircraft and the equipment we have to go and do missions. So it's very urgent. It's complex. Some of the challenges that we face, it's something, a word that's frequently used is, you know, tired iron. So we have parts and equipment that are basically, we've repaired them or we used them to the point where they're just worn out. So many of these items, you know, maybe we've been repairing them for 40 or 50 years. And as we know, as these, the planes continuing to fly longer, they're just not repairable anymore. And then on top of that, nobody's made it in decades. So you frequently cross that, and it's a very difficult spot to be when you may not have a lot of R&D budget to just go redesign, you know, complete systems. Another one that's fairly close related is just obsolescence and diminishing manufacturers. You know, when the average age of most of our platforms are older than most of the people working on the platforms, whether that's 30, 40, or even 50 years, a great deal of that technology is just old and doesn't exist anymore. Commercial items that was 30 years ago that was a commercial item is now just a sole source item to a commercial company that may not exist or almost for sure doesn't produce that part anymore. So how do you solve those problems? And then another just, I guess, general issue is a lot of these low dollar parts or things that were small, they're just not a priority to some of our bigger business party partners or OEMs. So we frequently have companies that no bid requirements, and we don't have much IP. So those are just some of the challenges we face in keeping some of these older weapon systems flying. What are some of the things that are something that industry can, you know, be a better partner? I think a lot of it's got to do with legacy data rights or licenses, rights to use the data, and really just being open to discuss the critical mission need. Many times just a small part is what grounds an airplane. And it's pretty amazing that you have, you know, something like a huge B-52, but it could just be, you know, maybe not a bolt, but a circuit card that's making it where we can't use that, and that aircraft's not, you know, ready.
All right. So excellent. Again, that makes a lot of sense. And again, people forget, you know, it was an O-ring, right, that brought the space shuttle down years ago. So yeah, those small parts definitely matter. And then you mentioned on it, you hit on this already, but a huge part of that industry government partnership involves IP, that intellectual property. So given AFSC's role in overhaul and modifications, IP and data rights are critical to maintaining vendor competition. So how is your team balancing the need to acquire necessary technical data while respecting industry's IP concerns?
So I would say, first off, I think we always respect IP. One is, you know, you don't want to get involved in litigation that actually just slows everything down. So I think we do a good job of respecting that. However, I will say at AFSC, we were pursuing a couple different avenues to get after that IP/data rights challenge. One of those areas is the push for licensing or even royalty agreements. So in my experience managing supply chain, it's not always the core business for some of our large OEMs to be managing some of these parts. Frequently it's, you know, sub of a sub. It's not a large profit base. It's not always the case, but frequently. So it's just not a priority. So what we've been trying to do, and they're still trying to do, is we prefer to work with our large OEMs to focus on, you know, allow them to focus on the things that are their core business, like developing and integrating new weapon systems, complex engineering challenges. We want them to focus their time and effort on that and free up, you know, that other time for the supply chains to allow us to work some of those things. So one of the things we were working through, and when I talk royalty and license rights, is that most of the OEMs aren't building these parts. So if they could, we could come to an agreement where the government could get that data, and then we could compete it amongst qualified vendors, and then have an agreement where we pay a royalty or a license back to the OEM, where they're still getting a return on that IP. We're still protecting that IP. However, we're able to manage and really increase potentially the vendor base, as we could compete. If we have the data, we could compete. And this really is a win-win for both industry and Air Force. Industry is getting a return on that IP, but they're not having to invest the time to manage the supply chain. And then for the Air Force, we're able to go directly to these vendors and potentially still get it, even with a royalty, paying less money and having an increased industrial base. So we've had a limited success so far. However, the discussions are ongoing. And all I think is it's going to take a couple successes. And to me, I see is this a real potential to maybe free that up to giving us the flexibilities to maybe work through some of these, you know, historic IP data rights challenges.
All right, sir. Again, it makes perfect sense and seems like a tremendous opportunity there for potential. And getting that balance has got to be tough, but getting it right is going to drive some massive value across the board. And then, so speaking of value, back in 2016, you were part of a team that won the Office of Secretary of Defense Outstanding Achievement Value Engineering Award. Can you share that maybe the story behind that achievement and explain how contracting officers can use value engineering to drive massive cost savings for the Air Force?
All right. Yeah. Yeah. Probably not a lot of contracting professionals that have the opportunity to win those types of awards. So what I will say is this was a team award, and it was really awarded to the team that I was on. And it was a multi-year two contracting procurement for C-130s. And then I think this is very relevant for today. We've seen a pretty large push from the administration to utilize multi-year procurement across the Department of War. So I think first, let's start off with, you know, what is a multi-year? So really, it's in summary, it's a congressionally approved multi-year commitment by the government to industry that's really guaranteeing, you know, multiple years and future years of appropriations to procure, you know, X number of either aircraft or something else. Often these deals include something called economic order quantity funding. For example, in the multi-year that I was the PCO for, we received $4 million per aircraft up front. So that was the whole 5 years of production. It was about, I think, 78 aircraft. So we received $300+ million up front to do things smart and to basically drive efficiencies. So what did we do? We used that money to invest in efficiencies. For example, we, Air Force and Lockheed Martin, incorporated several automation projects into the production line. These projects would have never been cost effective when we were talking about 1 year of aircraft procurement, because it just never, you know, got that return on investment when you're only talking 1 year. But when you then buy 80 to 100 aircraft, the automation made sense. And because we got money up front, we were then able to fund that up front. So significantly reduced the number of hand-drilled holes in the aircraft, which ultimately improved efficiency, but it also improved quality. Another part of that was as we agreed to the restructuring of work packages, really to drive what the actual mechanics and workers on the line were doing to drive to a more standard work processes in the production line. This effort required a investment in the first year, but then it drove higher learning and increased or higher, more reductions in labor in the out years. Overall, we basically achieved about a $25 million reduction in just the drive for standard work. And that was incorporated into the price and put into the contract. So because we had this unique thing called economic order quantity, which was $300 million up front to invest in efficiencies, which is part of a multi-year procurement, we were then able to do these things that return from a value engineering standpoint. And that's really what led to the team, which did include engineers as well on that team, to drive those savings. And I see it's being very relevant as that push from, like I said, from the administration to secure some of these multi-year deals to hopefully deliver more product at a lower price.
All right, sir. Excellent. And driving those efficiencies perfectly tees up my next topic here on acquisition transformation, which is, of course, on the top of everybody's mind today. So a recent executive order on improving acquisition places a heavy emphasis on stripping away bureaucratic red tape and streamlining the procurement process to get capabilities to the warfighter faster. So as the director managing a massive portfolio, how is LCMC operationalizing this EO to actually maybe shorten lead times? And where can the workforce expect to see the biggest changes in their day-to-day processes?
From a contracting perspective, as we've jumped into this acquisition transformation world, so contracting is really one of the first groups out the gate, working with some of these Tiger teams to implement the direction from the secretary. And so we were able to kind of work through this, and I think we're going to start to see some improvements or start to see some impacts. But first, I really think it just comes down to empowerment. Across the DAF, we have made significant delegations, pushing over 80% of the approvals and authorities to the COCOs. I mean, this is specific to systems contracting is really what I'm talking to versus, you know, some of our other areas. But 80%+ of the approvals to the COCOs, which are part of the PAE organizations. So really the majority are the only ones that have, you know, stayed at the SAE or HCA or SCO level are pretty much driven by statute. Anything else, we've pushed it down to the lowest level. CASPER is the new clearance process. So we've implemented that, and it's really a shift in the focus to more a risk-based assessment versus a compliance-based review. We've also looked at when the review occurs, and we've shifted those to other major milestones in the acquisition cycle. And then also we focused on utilizing existing documentation versus driving, you know, 100 chart decks for clearance, which we've kind of gone away from that in previous years, but still significant charts are no longer required. So I think those are two things where we've really shifted that, and we've, what I'll say is just empowered the team to go out and execute. For example, I mentioned CASPER. All of that authority, unless it's a special interest item, is at the COCO level, meaning there is no more, from a clearance perspective in systems and the PAE enterprise, coming to the SCO for clearance or to SAF AQC, unless it's identified as a special interest item by the SAE. So really looking forward to seeing if that delivers the speed. We believe it will. So it'll be interesting to see in the next year what really comes from that. Another area which has been around, but it became permanent in the 2026 NDAA is TINA Lite. This is available for sole source efforts over $50 million. And where the contractor has a meaningful history of delivering the same or similar products. So meaning we have actuals, we can get actuals, but there's a historic baseline. So you wouldn't want to use TINA Lite for a brand new development program because it wouldn't make any sense. It does require the contractor to certify, but it's not really tied to the specific RFO FAR Part 15 requirements that we're used to seeing in TINA. It allows us to tailor based on the data we need to get to fair and reasonable. So I think this has a lot of potential. So far, we have not had a lot of successes. So I think we need to continue to figure out ways to implement this, to get the data and the systems our contractors use, to get that transparency, to build that trust. And hopefully this will speed up the proposal process and the negotiation process. And again, at the end of the day, the contractors still have to certify that the data is, you know, accurate and complete and current. But I think it has the potential to speed up those proposal timelines. So excited about that opportunity as well.
Yeah, excellent, sir. Again, speed is critical. The efficiencies you speak of, the empowerment you speak of, and even getting the industrial base involved is also equally important. So another key pillar of that same executive order focuses on strengthening our domestic supply chains and making it easier for non-traditional defense contractors to do business with the government. So how is your team using this mandate to maybe transform our relationship with the industrial base and maybe lower the barriers to entry for those innovative commercial technology providers?
All right. So I think we talked to it a lot. You know, we're really pushing the OTs. There's various authorities under other transaction authority, CSOs. I think those are two things. One area that I would say is maybe it's not a new authority, but it's something we were doing at AFSC that I would like to talk through is really across the supply chain at AFSC, we were increasing the use of multiple award contractor MACs. And like I said, this isn't, you know, something new. It isn't a new tool. But I think we've deployed it in a different way that we've never done across the supply chain. So historically, we would have a large number of IDIQs across the supply chain for, you know, at the part level for, let's say, a major system or let's just say an engine. So that one engine, we may have 50 IDIQ contracts that we manage through the supply chain, probably 5 years, a bunch of contracts. We manage them all independently. So one of the things we've looked to is bringing those together in a MAC, really at that system level. So we'll just call it engine A. So we're going to now, where we had 100 IDIQ contracts, we're now going to pull all those together, all those requirements. We're going to put them all in a MAC and send that out. And the goal now is we're going to release that in every approved source that can produce one of those parts, however many parts it is, then if they're an approved source, well, then they would be eligible for award on that MAC. What that now does is it cuts down on the administration and provides the ability to do expedited award procedures, but it also allows us the ability to manage the MAC like a program. So now we can share future requirements with the entire industry base for that engine with the intent of, you know, as more vendors become approved source, we can add them with on-ramps. And now that we're sharing that, you know, grand view of everything across the entire engine, there may be a benefit or enough of a business case for these companies to expand what they historically have done and become approved sources for other parts. So the idea is, one, you would have the ability to have more transparency to industry to provide that greater demand signal. You would have repeatable competitions. So if you, in the past, where if you awarded one IDIQ for 5 years, well, in the course of that 5 years, if you had a competitive acquisition, well, at the end of that 5 years, typically you need to have made a part to maintain your ability to be an approved source. Well, under the MAC, now you could award to either multiple vendors or you could compete it every year with the expedited procedures. It wouldn't be administratively burdensome. So now you can keep that industry base, you know, keep that line hot and make sure that you have that capacity. So really, industry, we've had great feedback that they think it's a great opportunity. It's, like I said, less administratively burdensome. It allows for greater transparency. And we just, or the AFSC team just awarded really a big KC-46 commercial parts IDIQ or MAC IDIQ back in May-June timeframe. And there's going to be several more coming up and just really excited to the potential there. To just have that transparency and hopefully increase the number of industry partners that'll give us a broader industry base across some of these critical parts in our supply chain.
All right. Excellent, sir. And again, we're talking about, you know, new efficiencies and, again, empowerment of that workforce. And speaking of which, in order to make all that work, we do need that highly capable workforce. So in your role as director, you're responsible for training and developing a large number of civilian and military contracting professionals. So what critical skills do you feel are most needed in today's mid-level workforce? And what do we need to do to maybe close any gaps?
All right. So I think a lot of the areas are the same. We've been talking for years with maybe a few new ones. You still need to have the basis of sole source negotiations and have that background in pricing. You need to have the competitive acquisition background. So whether that's source selections, you really need to have that understanding to be a well-rounded mid-level contracting professional or journeyman contracting professional. I think I would say the area that's the newest is really those non-FAR based tools, whether it's OTAs, consortiums, CSOs. That's really the area that it's probably the newer that we need more focus. But I think it also comes down to the skills, and we've already discussed that, the ability to think critically. And I would say one of the biggest things is really just a positive action-oriented attitude of we're looking to act and to actually go do. We spend so much time, I'll say, talking through problems, what I like to say, admiring problems, but really just pushing that action-oriented culture of, hey, we're going to go and we're going to try new things and we're going to get after it. And if we make a mistake, we'll back up and then we'll do another action. So I think it's the core things, whether it's sole source, competitive, non-FAR based tools. That's really, and then also just the new RFO and all the other changes that are occurring, getting that training out. Because a lot of this is what I've, in meeting with teams, is teams will be following the old processes and then they're going along and they realize that they don't actually have to do that because there was an RFO change. So now they have a streamlined ability to do things faster. However, they didn't know that until they actually did it. So I think some of that's just learning by doing and ability to critically think and going really back to that action-oriented culture.
All right, excellent. And then as those mid-level journeymen move up, so does the mindset have to shift a little bit, maybe from tactical to operational to strategic? So, for example, you move from being a chief of contracting to a technical director at AFMC and then into the senior executive service. So what was the hardest mindset shift that you had to make when transitioning from maybe tactical contracting all the way up to enterprise level strategic leadership?
So I really think this kind of goes across your entire career, all the way from when you start as a new contract specialist, and you know, then you move up to a PCO, all the way to the, like you said, the COCO or the SCO level. So you're really shifting from being that doer of the tactical execution, whether it's writing a P&M or signing a contract, to become that teacher and that leader. I think the hardest shift is when we shift. You make that first shift from being a PCO to a supervisor. You know, many of our first level supervisors are carrying a PCO workload while also leading an organization, which I think is one of the hardest jobs we have in contracting is, and I'd really like to commend, you know, our NH3s and NH4 first level supervisors, because they have a very difficult job, because you're making that transition of, am I leading team? Do I need to, you know, actually get in and negotiate, sign this contract? So this is where you have to make that tough decision to really start investing in your team and let go of doing some of that work, the work that you did as a PCO. I think it goes back to the old saying, you give a person a fish and you feed them for a day, but you teach one to fish and you feed them for the rest of their life. But what I'll say is it takes a lot more time to teach somebody to fish. So it's an investment you have to make up front. But if you're leading a team of 10, and 10 people are doing the contracting work, they're going to have much more capacity than you as one individual. So you're really making that transition to lead. And then it comes down to you need to teach your folks, lead your team. Then you empower your team to make those decisions, and you have to kind of step away. You provide overall direction and instruction, but then you really just get out of the way and provide top cover. You know, they fall down, you pick them up and you provide that top cover, like I said, but you really just have to step away from that desire to solve the problem and that desire to really make the decisions, which is the whole first part of your career, which is a challenge, but you have to let that go and then move up to the higher level of how do you set up your organization to be successful and provide the resources versus actually make those tactical decisions.
Right, sir. Yeah, and that makes perfect sense, right? Letting go, but I'm comfortable. That's the stuff I like to do. And well, it's growth, right? Kind of need to let some of that go, as hard as it is, but train those that follow you so that they can follow in your footsteps. And so you may have covered this, but maybe there's another nugget out there. If you were sitting down with, say, a newly warranted CO today, What is the single most important piece of advice you would give them before they sign that first major contract?
Well, you know, they say the perfect contract is only one mod away. No, I'm just kidding. That's not what I would say. But I think what I would do is I would just ask them to think about, you know, what are they signing? What does that contract actually mean to the mission? You know, take it back to the purpose of why we do what we do. You know, what is that action literally doing if you think through it? Because it's either providing a service, a part, some piece of equipment, and then try to connect that. It'd be like, so what we're doing is not paperwork. What we're doing is a warfighting function, and we're delivering this signing of this contract is delivering a capability that is keeping an airman safe and out of harm's way, or allowing them to actually do their mission. And at the end of the day, that's protecting our freedoms and way of life as, you know, Americans. So I think if you, right from the beginning, you need to tie it back to why is it important and take it away that, you know, we're not just doing paperwork. We're doing something that's very critical that allows our Department of War to execute the mission that we have.
Right, sir. Absolutely. Again, great advice for today. And then looking forward to the future. Right. Well, actually, we're already here with the department's push towards digital material management and AI. So how do you see the day-to-day role of an Air Force contract specialist changing, say, over the next 5 to 10 years, if that role hasn't changed already?
So I think I'm going to try to just be a little maybe I'll think about outside the box a little bit, but I hope we see a lot more automation, specifically through our, you know, improved business system. So, you know, I'd like to see a ConIT, which has moved far beyond a contract writing system. It's become more of our entire business management system. Now, I know this is going to take money, and I know we got to finish rolling out ConIT, but I'd like to see the incorporation of, you know, AI tools or agents directly into our business management system, whether it's workload management, where we can manage our PCOs and our buyers' workload directly through our contract writing and business system. Electronic filing, that's been discussed, and I think there's a plan to incorporate that. But really, all of those things to kind of have more of an integrated interface that allows us to use tools across the enterprise. It would be great if you were in ConIT and you had your contract file and you could hit policy agent, and you hit that button and it does a complete policy review for what is required. Do you have all the documents? Do you have all your DNS? Do you have this? And then better yet, it doesn't just tell you what you need. Maybe it gives you a draft version of those, and then you can, you know, update your file so forth. So ultimately, what I would like to see is we capitalize on the AI, we capitalize on automation, to really return that bandwidth and time to our contracting professionals so they can engage in that higher level strategy and thinking, you know, remove the toll and just have more focus, more time to focus on those big problems. That's what I'd like to see. That might be a little aspirational, but I think the technology is out there. It's just how do we integrate those faster than really we ever have before.
Right, sir. Excellent. Yeah, I'm Gen AI. You know, great start, right? You know, you got ChatGPT, you've got the different AI agents out there to help. And again, that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg, right? I agree with you. It'd be lovely to, you know, take that and then incorporate that in some of our business systems. Absolutely. So, but it really comes down to the mission, right? So when a contracting workforce gets bogged down in policy and paperwork, it can be easy to maybe lose sight of that mission. So how do you keep your teams connected to that ultimate goal of supporting the warfighter? And I think you already mentioned this with, you know, talking to that first CO in their first contract, knowing what they buy. But any other words of wisdom there?
So I think as a leader, we have to be intentional. We have to make a focused effort to connect what we do to the mission, and we have to intentionally do that. So a few examples of how we can do this and how I've done this in previous organizations is, you know, bring in the users to share stories of, you know, connecting what you do to what they do, right? They can share those stories of how our contracting and acquisition community makes their job possible and keeps them safe and allows them to execute their mission. One thing that we instituted across AFSC was we conducted intel briefs. So we actually brought in our intel office and got them to create contract-specific intel briefs and brief those to the workforce, whether that's about threats, whether that's about supply chains. You know, it was a intel-specific brief to contracting. We got a lot of positive feedback, and it was pretty cool because they connected it to specific things tied to what we do. We need to take advantage of flight line production facility tours. You know, I think it's in my career, I've had the opportunity to go to several production facilities, whether that's, you know, F-35 or C-130 or some of the other ones. But taking the advantage to go actually see it, to me, that's an amazing thing to get to really see what we're doing and really the scale of some of these facilities. And I think we just have to remember to talk about it, you know, verbally make the connection, remind people, intentionally bring that back and connect it to what we do each and every day. Because at the end of the day, everything we do is done to protect our nation, our freedoms. Our airmen are counting on the acquisition community to deliver capability to allow them to complete their mission and come home safely. And I think it really just comes to that. And that kind of gets us to the why and brings us back to that purpose of why we do what we do.
All right. Excellent, sir. So, Mr. Fountain, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and insights. Your perspective on enterprise leadership and the future of our profession is exactly what our listeners need to hear right now. It's been a great conversation, and I'm grateful you could join us. Do you have any parting shots or other words of wisdom for our podcast listeners?
All right. Well, thank you, Rob. So I think I'm going to take the opportunity to say thank you to you for 40 plus years of service to the nation, the Air Force, and the contracting community. Many of the listeners out there to the podcast may not know that prior to being a podcast host, you've had a full career, whether that was enlisted or an officer in the Air Force for over 20 years, and then now being a civilian for another 20 years. So I just can't thank you enough for your service to the country and the nation, 40 plus years of service. So I just wanted to take the time to say thank you. I know you're retiring here pretty soon, but I didn't want to leave, sign off without just really sharing my appreciation for everything you've done. And, I've really enjoyed listening to you on the podcast over the last couple of years, and, just appreciate what you do. And thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, thank you, sir. No, appreciate that. And again, just grateful for all the opportunities along the way. And again, glad to be a part of the great team that we talked about here earlier. Awesome stuff. So on behalf of the Contracting Experience Podcast, all of our listeners and subscribers, thank you so much for joining us today. Mr. Fountain, it has been a pleasure having you. So as always, a huge thanks to all of our podcast listeners, followers, and subscribers. If you have any feedback, suggestions for topics, or future guests you would like to hear on the podcast, you can submit those via email to thecontractingexperience@gmail.com. And as a reminder, you can subscribe to the Contracting Experience Podcast from any of your podcast listening platforms. Be sure to subscribe to receive updates and automatic downloads so you don't miss a single episode. I'm your host, Rob Lorton, from the AFMC Contracting Digital Division, and I hope you can join us again on our upcoming episodes. Until then, stay tuned and stay connected.